This is Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Matt Gellum, in for Steve Chiotakis. Almost 7 years ago, LA voters passed a $1 billion bond to add new homeless housing in the city, Proposition HHH. Since then, you've likely heard a lot about how slow progress has been, how expensive the housing is to build, which is true, but today, some good news. LA is finally seeing the fruits of Prop HHH in a big way.
So if someone was walking through with us and you had to describe everything here, what are we looking at?
The stove, the refrigerator, of course, the sink by the window. That's what I've always wanted. Over here is my bed.
This is Olga Rosario showing KCRW reporter Anna Scott her new studio apartment in Sylmar. This building is one of dozens opening this year, funded with help from Prop HHH.
The shower has,
it has a bathtub.
Yeah, it is a big bathroom. They made it really big.
And you
can see, I love beach.
Seashells.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got a lot of beach.
Yeah.
Finally, thousands of new units like this one are opening throughout the year. So why did it take so long to get here? And what will all these openings mean for LA's homelessness crisis? Anna picks up the story from here.
Cooking is one of the best parts of living here for Olga. It's something she couldn't do at the shelter she stayed in before this, or in the spot under a nearby bridge where she slept for a couple of years before that.
I cook mainly chicken. I love chicken. I don't know. I could eat chicken every day if I wanted it. Tacos, chicken tacos.
Olga is 62. She has a long history of financial instability, mental health issues, and addiction. And having a stable apartment doesn't erase the trauma of the past. It can be hard to suddenly have the time and space to think. Some nights she thinks about what could go wrong here, like the building burning down.
It kind of gets to the point where you just lay here and pray all night.
To help with the anxiety and other issues, Olga sees a therapist here in the building every week. Like all HHH projects, this is what's known as permanent supportive housing, meaning subsidized apartments for low-income tenants, with services like physical and mental health care. It's designed specifically for people who were previously homeless for a year or more and have disabilities. There's a huge need for housing like this. More than a third of the nearly 42,000 people who are unhoused inside LA city limits fit those criteria. One of the criticisms of Prop HHH, even from people inside City Hall, has been that in the face of this urgent need, it's simply too slow. After all, it took 3 years after the measure passed in late 2016 for the first HHH-funded building to open.
And it's hard to defend yourself, you know, by saying it's coming soon, it's coming soon.
Anne Sewell is the head of LA's city housing department. Now, she says, city officials can finally say, it's here. LA has reached the crest of HHH, with 49 buildings scheduled to open in 2023, containing thousands of new apartments. Anne says it was always going to take a long time to reach this point. But that wasn't widely understood when voters approved Prop HHH.
There was just this so much excitement around finally having resources that the fact that they weren't immediately generating places to live was a huge letdown for, I think, a lot of people.
At the same time, the wonky fine print of the measure didn't jibe with the expectations around it. The big promise of Prop HHH was that it would create 10,000 new units of housing for the city's chronically homeless. But before Prop HHH ever passed, the city was already building a few hundred units of permanent supportive housing each year. And really, the measure was designed to add an extra 7,000 apartments to that over 10 years.
You simply cannot explain that in a campaign, right? You can't sit there and go, well, you know, it's really going to be 7,000, but we're going to call it 10,000 because we're adding in the city's 3,000. So what people heard was we're going to do 10,000 units. And they completely ignored the fact that we were going to do them over 10 years.
Still, some maintain that it didn't have to take this long, that city leaders could have been more ambitious than simply plugging $1 billion into the status quo system for building affordable housing, which is a pretty inefficient system. Like LA's former city administrative officer, Miguel Santana, he told me there's a lot LA could do better in the future if it gets another chance, like
fast tracking the permit process and the entitlement process through the city. and, you know, really placing the needs of the unhoused at the center.
Including the need for immediate affordable housing of all kinds, from regular cheap apartments to the deeply subsidized supportive apartments that Prop HHH is helping to fund. The measure won't solve chronic homelessness in the city of LA, but it's produced more than 2,300 apartments to date, a number expected to more than double this year and next. At a time when Mayor Karen Bass is pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into breaking up encampments and moving people off the streets, those units could be a lifeline for people who otherwise might languish in shelters. Like Olga Rosario, who says she used to walk by the building where she lives now when it was still under construction.
I would always, before it was finished, I would always come down San Fernando Road. And I don't know why, but I would say, oh, God, just put me over here. And look, I got placed where I was actually wanting to be placed.
Ultimately, by 2026, Prop HHH is expected to help the city produce 10,519 permanent supportive housing units, about 500 more than it's set out to create. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA here on KCRW, I'm Matt Gillum. LA is home to the largest diaspora of Filipinos outside of the Philippines, which is thousands of miles away, so immigrating to the U.S. is no small deal. A lot of those immigrants come for jobs in LA, New York, and other cities. In the play On This Side of the World, the stories of Filipinos working in America take center stage to give people an idea of just how far they've come. It's playing now in Little Tokyo at the East-West Players at David Henry Hwang Theater. Steve Chutekis recently talked with co-directors Paolo Tirol and Noam Shapiro about the production. Here's their conversation.
Hi, Noam and Paolo. I'm so glad that you came on with us. Paolo, I wonder if you would tell us a little bit about the play On This Side of the World. What's the thrust of it?
Sure. On This Side of the World, it's a musical that is inspired by the Filipino immigrant experience in the U.S. In On the Side of the World, we follow a woman named Gemelyn, and she is a Filipino who has boarded a flight to the U.S. with a one-way ticket and a suitcase of stories. She's going to be a high school teacher in the Bronx, and she is very anxious, very apprehensive as the flight takes off, because she is leaving everything she knows, and she's going to a place that she knows nothing about. And at the beginning of the flight, amidst her apprehension, she realizes that she remembers that in preparing for this flight, this one-way ticket flight, she had actually collected stories from immigrants who went before her. And so she spends the flight recollecting stories, but also connecting with her fellow passengers and helping them with their own apprehensions and their own anxiety about going to a place that's totally new, exchanging the stories. And when they land, they can now face the unknown future with a lot more confidence and courage.
Noam, when it comes to the music and lyrics of the play, talk a little bit about how you blend these two worlds musically, you know, the Philippines and America. They're two very different places.
Sure. Well, Paolo is both the composer and the lyricist of the piece. I am the director and co-creator of it, so I helped Paolo think about how to organize the stories and build a framework for how they operate. One of the questions that we often get asked is, what does Filipino music actually sound like, and how do the different genres of the stories cohere into one musical? We think of the show kind of as an anthology of short stories as opposed to a novel, so you meet lots of different characters, and each has a different musical style or genre, whether it's pop music or an operetta style of music, a ballad or a torch song, or music that's reminiscent of kind of 90s R&B. All of that is included. And part of that is because a lot of the popular music in the Philippines, as I've learned from working with Paolo, is really informed by American popular music as a product of American colonialism about a century ago. So you have all of these genres that, when you think about Filipino music, it really frequently sounds like American music, aside from some more indigenous rhythms and Latin influences from Spanish colonialism as well.
Let's hear an example of that, and we can play it, and we'll talk about it on the other side of this.
A brand new passport, a lunch Lola packed, 3 bags weighing 99 pounds, and a jeep load of people from school, from the market, from church, pretty much my whole town. We're crammed on the curb by the terminal door, me and this family of mine. There's hugs and there's kisses, there's tears and there's wishes, 'cause soon I leave them behind. See the passengers only sign, then it's 1,095 days at the least, 3 years till I see them again.
So that is one of the songs, One Way Ticket, in the play. Paolo, I wonder if you can talk about, One Way Ticket. You're talking about, obviously, the woman who has a one-way ticket to the United States and wants to be a teacher in the Bronx. That distance from Manila to the Bronx is what, like 8,400 miles, isn't it?
8,491 miles. It is actually in the lyrics of One Way Ticket. Because in One Way Ticket, they're like pretty much enumerating all the different ways that they're far away. The fact that if you're in a 3-year contract, it's going to be 1,095 days till you see people again. It's 12 time zones difference, but at certain times of the year, it's 13 time zones difference. It's 8,491 miles.
It almost sounds like rent.
I mean, not to quote from one of my favorite musicals.
Well, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, but when you think about all that mileage, and my dad immigrated to the United States from Greece. I know, thousands mm-hmm. of miles away from home, that feeling of being a stranger in a strange land. How do you incorporate that into this performance?
Oh my gosh. So I'm an immigrant myself. I moved at age 34 in 2012. So I was like a fully formed adult with a whole life behind me in the Philippines. And I just decided I want to shift to music. And so I left my family, my career behind. And I'm just like, I'm going to start again as an undergrad in music school. And it's so many ways. One of the characters in One Way Ticket. So in One Way Ticket, you have six Filipinos boarding their plane boarding their flight to the U.S. with a one way ticket. And one of them is a young woman who sings about going to a school she only ever dreamed of. And in this song, everyone is going for a certain reason, but they also have their own fears that they bring with them as they board the flight. And this person is like, she is anxious that she's going to have to rebuild and start over from everything. We learn that she's an achiever in school. She's kind of type A. She does have the respect of her peers, but now that she's moving to the States, it's like she's going to have to start all over again, which was kind of the feeling I had. I'm very type A. I had this whole corporate career behind me. I had a music career, not in musical theater in the Philippines, but yeah, here I was starting over to a place where no one knew who I was, no one cared who I was or where I came from.
Well, maybe at first, but you amass friends, you amass, your new family in the new
yes.
land, right?
And that is also a theme that's touched on in the show. There are love songs which are also kind of inspired by my experience, by friends' experiences, where people are able to find home because they find love in a place they never expected. They find the feelings of love and the feelings of home in a place they never expected.
And there's also, you asked about...
Go ahead, Noam. Go ahead.
How the kind of the worries or the distance is expressed in the lyrics and in the songs. The kind of structure of the show is such that these six individuals who really do feel alone with their concerns board this plane, and by the end of this flight, they've become a bit of a community, each recognizing one another's fears and apprehensions about starting this new life. And so you sense as they head out into their new lives in the United States that they are not, in fact, alone, that they are just six travelers out of so many, like your father, like Paolo, who have made the journey across borders, both land and sea, to get to the United States.
What's it like, Noam, to direct? I mean, we're talking vignettes, basically, right? With so many different mm-hmm. people. What's yeah. it like directing something like that on stage? Because you're literally directing six different performances. Right?
It's a blast. I just spoke with our costume designer, and she said there are like 59 separate looks for all the different characters over the course of the show.
Ooh.
That's so different from a traditional musical or a play, and what that demands from the actors is just tremendous acrobatics. Each actor gets to play like huge comedy and also deep, deep tragedy. And for these actors, that's just like the best opportunity ever to really show their whole range. And so we're talking about how do you shift your physicality between a character who is much older and a character who is closer to your age? How do you express vocally and in your performance excitement and love versus fear or desperation? We've been talking about, like, if your character was an animal, what kind of animal would it be? If your character led with a part of their body, what kind of part of their body would they lead? And that's a way that these actors can really quickly tap into a different personality as they leave the stage in one moment as one character and then immediately re-enter as another character. It's really fun.
And I should say, Steve, you mentioned six vignettes. There are actually not just six. So you have the six characters on the plane, and they're all telling stories. And there are, I think, 21 stories throughout the musical. So these six characters are telling 21 stories, some of which are a story about one person, some of which are a story about six people. So I think all in all, which is why Jamie, our costume designer, said there are 59 different looks, because there's like that many characters in this show. So it's very exciting to see. It's very exciting not only to see Noam like bring it to the stage, in terms of the actors, in terms of the designs that have been coming up, but also in the way that the actors have been responding to it. Because in one second, they're playing a spoiled brat on the Upper East Side. The next moment, they are playing an older church lady, an older gossipy church lady. So it's a whole lot of fun.
And Noam's got to direct all it. So Noam, eat your Wheaties, right? Have a green smoothie, because you got a lot on your plate, my friend.
And lots of cups of coffee.
Lots of cups of coffee. Thank you both for coming on. Good luck with the play. Paolo Tirol, Noam Shapiro, thank you both for talking with us today. By the way, if you'd like more information on this side of the world, head on over to our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Back now with more of Greater LA. I'm Matt Gillum. Once again, the Sheriff's Department is in hot water in Orange County. A public defender says she's gathering documents that show OC deputies used the same evidence to charge two completely different men with drug crimes back in 2020. It's not the first time the officers in the scandal-plagued OC Sheriff's Department, or even the officers involved in this incident, have been accused of mishandling evidence. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist for the LA Times and a regular on GLA, and he's here to fill us in. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Matt.
All right, so give us some background on this case. What is this public defender alleging?
So in 2020, there was a raid in a motel in Buena Park, and sheriff's deputies, they arrested a man for possession of meth. And so that same day, they also arrested another man. But 2 weeks later, the evidence that was used against the first man that they had arrested was put into evidence for the second man, even though they had nothing to do with each other, even though there was no, like, those men had no connection other than they were arrested in the same motel, even though it was different rooms at different times.
Right. So one evidence, two men. I mean, how could evidence wind up getting moved from one case to another?
Right now, the sheriff's department is not talking. When they talk, they'll probably say, oh, you know, it was misplaced. those things happen. Oh, well, our bad. But in a defense motion by the public defender, by Tammy Nguyen, she's alleging this was done on purpose. She's alleging that this was something that sadly seems to be part of the sheriff's department for at least the past 25 years, which is planting of evidence, breaking of the law, unethical at the very, very least, and probably more so. And sadly, with the public defender's office over the past decade, they and also private defense attorneys, these sort of cases seem to be happening with the sheriff's department again and again, even though they keep claiming, oh, we're going to clean ourselves up. We're not going to be like our predecessors.
Well, I mean, speaking of cleaning up or a history here, I mean, what do we know about these officers that are involved in the incident? One of them has had issues before, right?
Both of them. So there were two sheriff's investigators at the time, Matt LaFleur and Arthur Tiscareno, and they were both accused of mishandling evidence in the past. LaFleur specifically, he was actually an investigator into evidence booking scandals back in 2019, but then he was removed after his superiors found out that he had mishandled evidence. And then there was also a phone call where Matt LaFleur was listening in, allegedly, to an inmate call with their attorney, which you're not supposed to do without letting them know. And at one point, the inmate's attorney says, hey, if this person is Matt LaFleur's listening, don't listen because we'll put this into court. So these two sheriff's deputies have faced scandal in the past. And although they were investigators in 2020 when this particular incident with the meth in Buena Park happened, they have both been promoted to sergeants.
All right. So what do you think happens next with the double dipped evidence? Will this wind up at trial?
Oh, gosh. Well, if it's true, then I could see a mistrial because you're not supposed to plant illegal evidence into someone's case. And the man who was originally arrested for meth possession, he had pleaded guilty. So that case is already done. But the second man, the one who was arrested on the same day, but had that evidence put in his case, Ace Kelly, he had pleaded not guilty. We'll see what happens. Obviously, with something like this, if the allegations from Tammy Nguyen are true, this case is not going to go anywhere. It's going to be thrown out, and there's going to be yet another scandal for the sheriff's department, for Orange County Sheriff Don Barnes, who said that he wasn't going to be like his predecessor, Sandra Hutchins, who said that she wasn't going to be like her predecessor, Mike Corona, who said that he wasn't going to be like his predecessor, Brad Gates. So it's the same old song at the Orange County Sheriff's Department.
All right, Gustavo, let's look to L.A. now. We just lost a giant in local politics, Gloria Molina, who you've written about extensively for The Times. I mean, she was an absolute trailblazer, first Latina assembly member in California, first Latina on the L.A. City Council, first Latina on the L.A. County Board of Supervisors. Just offer us some reflections on her legacy and the impacts that you see this one person having on such a massive city.
Talk about contrast, right? Like, we just talked about the sheriff's department scandal plagued. Gloria Molina, even though she was in L.A., she was the complete opposite of that. She always preached the gospel of good governance. There was never any scandal attached to her at all. And so she's not just an exemplar for Latinas, for women, for Mexican-Americans. She really should be set as the gold standard for what all politicians should do. So even down in Orange County, we can learn so many lessons from Gloria. There's obviously going to be so many remembrances of her, and there is going to be a public commemoration of her life at La Plaza de Cultura y Artes. And I just hope everyone learns. Be more like Gloria, be less like the Orange County Sheriff's Department.
How do you hope Angelinos remember her?
As a trailblazer, but also, again, someone that all politicians should aspire to be like. There was never any scandal attached to her. Sadly, that's not what's going on at LA City Hall over the past 5 years, if not decade, where you see so many politicians being brought down by corruption. I had the honor of being able to talk to Gloria a few weeks after she announced that she was going to pass away from cancer. And I told her, what do you want Angelinos to remember you by? And she said, don't be corrupt. Truly, words to live by.
Gustavo Arellano is a columnist at the LA Times. Gustavo, thanks so much for being with us.
Gracias.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, local wildlife biologists are hoping that getting rid of dams on streams in Malibu will bring back the southern steelhead trout that used to be plentiful in those waters. We'll hear more about those efforts tomorrow on GLA. Our website is kcrw.com/GLA. Jump on there to give us feedback on the show. Let us know about stories we should be covering and get the podcast. That's kcrw.com/GLA. Of course, you can also get the podcast at any of the various outlets by searching KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mea, Zoe Matthew, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together today. I'm Matt Gillum. Thanks so much for being with us, and have a fantastic evening.